Hello, this is Bobby Hardy with the News Gazette for Saturday and Sunday, February 15th and 16th, 2020. We're going to start with the headline, He Needs to Pay. At 1:15 p.m. Friday, more than 10 years after Tony Cassano found her daughter Holly murdered, she was told the jury had reached a verdict, triggering an emotional response. Minutes later, Michael Henslake was found guilty. He faces mandatory life in prison at his sentencing. Day in court. Verdict. Verdict reached in an hour, backs devoid of mercy claim. This is from Urbana. For 9 years, Michael Henslake has hidden in plain sight from the authorities who were looking for Holly Cassano's killer. When he was arrested in late August 2018, the man convicted of Miss Cassano's murder was living a few blocks north of the home in Candlewood Estates Mobile Home Park in Mahomet, where she drew her last breath on November 2, 2009. For parts of those 9 years, Henslake lived with his parents in another street in Candlewood Estates. He had attended the same high school as she did, a couple of years behind her. He was 21 at the time of the murder and is now 31. Miss Cassano had just turned 22. Although DNA belonging to him was found all over her home, extracted from blood and semen, it took years to get a match. Henslake, a convicted felon, had deftly avoided giving his court-ordered DNA sample to the state of Illinois for inclusion in its database, an act that might have led police to him sooner. Deputies got samples from many men in the mobile home park, as well as friends and acquaintances of Miss Cassano, but Henslake was not among the 190 standards. Instead, it took services of a private company hired by the Champaign County Sheriff's Office that combs databases filled with DNA of people who want to know about their ancestry and combines that with public record searches to focus in on people with DNA similar to that left in the scene. That company, Paraben Nano Labs in Virginia, narrowed the search to Henslake in the summer of 2018, and because his DNA wasn't in any database anywhere, police tailed him for a few days to get it. Two of his discarded cigarette butts did the trick. On August 28, 2018, the day sheriff's investigators learned from the state crime lab that DNA from Henslake's cigarettes matched the DNA found in Miss Cassano's home, they arrested him. 5 hours later, he had confessed to the previously unsolved brutal killing that had consumed her family, friends, law enforcement, and the village of Mahomet for almost a decade. On Friday, after 3 days of testimony, it took the 8 women and 4 men sitting in judgment of Henslake just 1 hour to conclude he committed first-degree murder. They also found his repeated stabbing and sexual assault of the single mother was exceptionally brutal and heinous and indicative of wanton cruelty. Judge Heidi Ladd will sentence Henslake on March 30th. The hearing will be pro forma. Life behind bars is mandated. About 50 people packed the courtroom Friday morning for approximately 3 hours of closing arguments. Many in attendance were sheriff's investigators who had worked on the case. Others were curious courthouse employees. Many were friends and family members of both Miss Cassano and Henslake. Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lazar argued that the jurors had ample evidence to find Henslake guilty, noting that the physical evidence matched his statements to sheriff's investigators Dwayne Rolfs and Chris Starr. Look at his confession in light of Dr. Scott Denton's testimony. Along with Dwayne Morris, the blood splatter analysis, along with the crime scene investigator to see how they fit, Lazar said, adding the DNA found in the house that matched Henslake was the clincher. Denton performed the autopsy on Miss Cassano, estimating she sustained 55 to 60 stab wounds, that she bled to death internally, and that it likely took 3 to 7 minutes for her to die. Lazar then reviewed for the jury Henslake's statement, more than half of which was his denial of knowing her or even being involved, followed by his admission of stabbing her, cutting himself in the process, and having sex with her corpse. Henslake told Rolfs and Dar that she was sleeping when he began stabbing her. She is helpless and harmless. He could have left, Lazar said. He did not have to do any of this. He could have dealt with his issues. Instead, Lazar said, he stabbed her through a blanket as she lay on her bed. Henslick told them she woke, saying, "What?" and "Help." She is quite literally asking for mercy. What does he do? He stabs her more, devoid of mercy, consciously intending to inflict pain on her, Lazar said. He knows how much damage he's done. If he's only intent with just to kill her, there's no reason to continue to stab and stab and stab. But he didn't stop, Lazar said, arguing for the brutal and heinous finding. First Assistant Public Defender Lindsay Yankus argued that sheriff's investigators made assumptions after learning that the blood and semen in the home belonged to only one male. They weren't running down other leads looking into other people who had problems with Holly. That is an enormous assumption, she said. She tried mightily to create doubt about the statistical analysis applied by the state crime lab analyst to the DNA found at the scene. Scientist Dana Pitchford had testified the odds were 1 in 150 octillion that the DNA and the evidence came from someone other than Henslick. Yonkis further argued that the crime lab's testing of only 9 pieces of evidence, all of which showed the same DNA profile that ultimately matched Henslick, was not enough. That is less than 1% of the available evidence in this case. Does that come close to beyond a reasonable doubt? They had 9 years to test more evidence, she argued. I want to be clear. I do not believe the state has come close to meeting its burden that Michael did this, she said, going on to say that if the jury did believe he was guilty, then they shouldn't believe he was brutal and heinous. You have to find intentional infliction of pain, she said. There simply is not evidence to justify that in this case. Yonkis argued that the evidence suggested Miss Cassano may have been unconscious or even dead when many of her wounds were inflicted and therefore not aware of the pain. She also tried to convince the jury that Henslick's confession was coerced by the detectives, a notion the judge had rejected before trial when she listened to it and ruled the jury could hear much of it. There is not any detail provided by Michael in that statement that was not fed to him, Yonka said. Back to the front cover here, the other story about this trial. The reaction. Mother, investigators, attorneys relieved over quick outcome. This is out of Urbana. Toni Cassano said her faith has sustained her the last 10 years as police looked for the person who took her only daughter out of her life, then found him and brought him to justice. I have spiritually forgiven him, but that doesn't mean I think what he did was okay, the Villagrove woman said. I do believe that he needs to pay for what he did, and that's between him and God. As Cassano was talking with the News Gazette on Friday afternoon, word came that a jury had reached a verdict in the murder trial of Michael Henslick just an hour after it began deliberating. She was stunned by the speed of jurors' decision. Since unwittingly being thrust into the spotlight in 2009, Toni Cassano has been the model of composure and civility, freely talking to the media as the search for her daughter's killer went on. Then, after Henslick's arrest, she measured her words carefully as she attended almost all of his court hearings. While testifying Tuesday about how she found her daughter's slain body cold and stiff, she held it together on the witness stand, choking back a sob. In the hallway outside the courtroom on breaks this week, she spoke kindly of Henslick's mother and aunt and did her best to comfort her own relatives and friends who were hearing the grisly details of how Holly Cassano's life ended. But when Judge Heidi Ladd read aloud the guilty verdict, Toni Cassano buried her face in her hands and sobbed, her body visibly heaving for several seconds. Her adult son next to her put an arm around her and held tight. So how has she not let the grief consume her? God. I look at this as my faith journey. I start out knowing God. When this happened, I hated God, said the mother of two, who is raising her late daughter's only child, now 12. So as not to prejudice Henslick's right to a fair trial, prosecutors were not allowed to introduce evidence that Holly Cassano was a mother of an 18-month-old girl at the time of her slaying. The judge even forbade the lawyers from sending the jury a photo of Miss Cassano's purse on her daughter's bed because in the background is a pull-up diaper. However, in a picture shown two jurors of the mostly naked Miss Cassano on the floor of her bedroom, there was a child's plastic tricycle just inches from her foot that may have given them a clue. I had steps that I felt God wanted me to take, and the hardest one was the forgiveness, she said. We spoke many times at church about forgiveness. I kept telling my pastor I couldn't do it. I wasn't ready. He reassured me it wasn't when I did it, but that I did it, and I would know when. During one Sunday sermon about forgiveness, she said she looked at the cross and said, God, I get it. God surprised me, and I learned that forgiveness was about me, not me forgiving someone else, she said. I reflected upon my life and realized I had done things I wasn't always proud of. At the end of that sermon, I talked to my pastor and said I was ready for forgiveness. I walked out of the church that day with the weight lifted off of me. By the end of that week, I was getting a knock on my door from detectives saying that they had caught the person who had killed my daughter. For years, Cassano has been in close telephone contact with sheriff's detectives and has made a habit of visiting their office periodically. They let her park in the employee lot. As spectators filed from the courtroom Friday, she hugged Dave Shurick, the lead investigator for years, then fellow investigator Dwayne Rolfe, and Chris Darr in the back of the courtroom. That same trio had delivered the news to Hensley's, of Hensley's arrest to her at her home August 28, 2018. I think the state's attorney's office did a really good job, she told the News Gazette. After the jury had cleared the courtroom, Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lazar hugged State's Attorney Julia Reitz, who had tears in her eyes. Hensley's public defender, Lindsay Yonkus, and Andrea Bergstrom exchanged words with their client and his family. After the judge and jury had, and most of the spectators had left the courtroom, Henslick, who had shown no emotion during the trial, gave News Gazette photo editor Robin Schultz a familiar middle finger salute. He was then taken back to the holding cell, and the judge having revoked his $1 million bond. Afterward, the investigators tried to temper their excitement over the verdict with the palpable loss of a young woman they knew only in death. I'm extremely proud of the Champaign County Sheriff's Office, Dave Shurick and Dwayne Rolfe, and the talent they brought to the case, said Darr, who helped Rolfe in the later part of Hensley's confession. I just keep thinking about the Cassano family and how they finally got their day. They waited a long time, Darr said, adding he hoped the people of Mahomet directly affected by the murder would get some needed closure. Shurick agreed, declaring, "We're glad it's over." Rolfe applauded the team effort that brought the case to a close, noting that all of the detectives had other cases to work on in the 9 years they investigated Miss Cassano's killing, one they refused to ever call a cold case. For 1.5 years since the arrest, the whole time my thoughts were how that family waited for this day, and for it to be Valentine's Day is just special, Rolfe said. From the first deputy on scene to every investigator to every expert, everyone involved in this case was incredibly dedicated and professional and made it a pleasure to try this case, Reed said. Champaign County should be proud. On to another headline. Award a testament to Nugent's impact. This is out of Champaign. On Thursday, University of Illinois men's wheelchair basketball coach Matt Bucci got a heads up that a big honor was on the way for the late Tim Nugent. Bucci wasn't a bit surprised. Nugent, the longtime director of the University of Illinois Disability Resources and Educational Services Center, is joining an elite company again. The father of accessibility, already a member of the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Hall of Fame, was named the winner of the Bunn Lifetime Achievement Award by the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame on Friday. If there's anybody in wheelchair basketball that's going to be honored for that role or in any capacity, it's Dr. Nugent, said Bucci, who is hosting a tournament this weekend at the ARC. He has given so much opportunity for adaptive sports for people with disabilities. He deserves all the accolades and honors he can get. UI graduate Bucci has been the coach at his alma mater since 2012. Nugent's long-ago efforts set the stage for the growth of wheelchair sports. We're constantly trying to work underneath his legacy and trying to keep up to the capacity that it is, Bucci said. He was one that just didn't take no for an answer and pushed so much. He gave us the opportunities that we have today. The annual Bun Award, which was started in 1973, is given to the international or national figure who has contributed greatly to the game of basketball. Outside of enshrinement, the Bun Award is the most prestigious award presented by the Basketball Hall of Fame. As the founder and original commissioner of the National Wheelchair Basketball Association, we appreciate Nugent's contributions to the game we celebrate, said former Illini Jerry Conalego, who serves as chairman of the Hall of Fame. Nugent, who died in 2015 at age 92, will be honored August 28th through the 30th during the Hall of Fame Enshrinement Weekend in Springfield, Massachusetts. The list of past recipients include a who's who of basketball greats. Among those honored were legends John Wooden from UCLA, Henry Ickman of Oklahoma State, Red Auerbach of Boston Celtics, Ray Meyer of DePaul, and Pat Summitt of Tennessee. Retiring Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney was honored in 2015. Former Illini Johnny Red Kerr was selected in 2009. Was Nugent the Wooden of wheelchair basketball? Honestly, I don't even know anybody was that compares to what Dr. Nugent is, Bucci said. He wasn't just a coach. He was somebody that pushed so many boundaries for us. Created the NWBA here in 1949. He did so much for us. He just didn't stop. There are so many student athletes here and wheelchair athletes across the country that owe him so much. Bucci first met Nugent during his days as a student from 2003 to 2008, and later when he took over as coach. He always took time to speak to us, give us some advice, and just support us in general, he said. He's always special to our hearts here in Illinois. How would Nugent react to this latest honor? He would tell everybody about all of the people that helped him do that, and that it was not just him, even though he was the catalyst that was really pushing all the way. We'll move on to the sports section. Illini wins season opener. Aide hits two-run homer in UI debut. This is out of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Dan Hartlib said 3 days before the season started, he wasn't worried about not having, at least on paper, a big bat in the lineup. The longtime Illinois baseball coach was more focused on having a balanced lineup with no easy outs from 1 through 9. Friday night's season opener against Milwaukee didn't see the Illini pile up a bunch of hits, but two newcomers did break through for the biggest hits in the 3-2 Illinois victory at David F. Couch Ballpark at Wake Forest University. Nathan Ade sent a two-run opposite field home run to right field on a 3-2 count in his first at-bat as the Illini in the second inning. Former Parkland College standout Alex Steinbach later doubled to score Ade in the fourth. Those three runs were enough as old reliables Ty Weber and Garrett Acton held the Panthers in check. It was great for that to be the first at bat, Ade said of his second inning homer. It was an even bigger thing that it put us on top to help us win the game. That's obviously the most important thing. Ade, Steinbach, and Taylor Jackson, all three of whom came from the junior college ranks and were making their debut in Illinois, who is 1-0, accounted for the four of the Illinois six hits, with Jackson, a former Kirkwood Community College standout, going 2 for 5. It's a solid opening night win, said Hartlab, whose Illini will be back in action at 9 a.m. Saturday in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, against Stanton Hall, who is 0-1. We got some very good at-bats from some new guys in the lineup. I'm very pleased with their approach. Big days for the new guys. Weber, a veteran Illini now in his fourth season in Champaign, delivered 6 innings of four-hit, one-run ball finishing with 6 strikeouts against the Panthers, who were 0-1. Acton notched his 20th career save as an Illini, striking out Zach Nogolowski for the final out with a run on the first after a two-out walk. Ty did such a good job, Hartlab said. That's what we need him to do, not only for the win, but we needed the young guys to watch somebody be very efficient. On to another sports headline. Knudsen helps Rockets end long regional title drought. This is out of Maroa. Elise Knudsen embraced one Unity Girls basketball supporter after another Friday night. Some were family, other friends, all sported grins from ear to ear, just like Knudsen. The Rockets senior probably felt like she'd received a hug from the entire community of Tolono, Philo, Sydney, Pisodum, and Sadorus that make up Unity when all was said and done. They're proud of us, Knudsen said. We're proud to be part of Rocket Country, and so are we. Extending a postseason run in dramatic fashion will have that effect. Knudsen racked up a game-high 31 points to help Unity end an IHSA hardware drought dating back to 2009, as the fourth-seeded Rockets staved off top-seeded Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin 56-53 in the Class A2 Maroa Forsyth Regional Championship game. Junior Chloe Reed added six shots from beyond the arc for all 18 of her points as Unity 22-9 took another step in its rapid turnaround under second-year coach Dave Ehlers. We were 10-20 last year, and nobody gave us a chance this year or anything else, Ehlers said. We just took in the thought that there was no pressure on us. We were just going to come out and play our game, and whatever happened, happened. This win versus the Blue Devils, 27-6, allowed Knudsen to finally check off a significant box on her high school bucket list. It means so much, said Knudsen, who earlier this month snagged Unity's all-time scoring record from Brian Cardinal with her 1,813th point. When I walked into high school, that's what I wanted was a regional plaque, and to get it in my senior year means so much. Friday's action didn't start off in a fashion that suggested the Rockets soon would be singing their school song in front of eloquent, elated fans prior to accepting the regional plaque. BHRA's Emma Clapp erupted for a trio of three-pointers in a little over 5 minutes, pushing the Blue Devils to a 13-2 advantage. She later added another triple and finished with 14 points. When you look at that score in the 50s, you know we're kind of out of our element here, said BHRA coach Mike Stevens, whose athletes averaged 43.4 points during a 10-game win streak they carried into the regional final. But we certainly hung tough Friday. It was a heck of a basketball game. One element working in the Rockets' favor was a familiarity with trailing in this gymnasium. Unity fell behind Illini Central on February 1st in Maroa during an Illini Prairie Sangamon Challenge game, but rallied to win in overtime. In Thursday's regional semifinal, the Rockets overcame a 12-point deficit entering the last quarter to stun Oakwood. So, slipping on early on the floor was old hat by this time. It happened on Friday. We've had many games where we've been down, and then we've come out on top in most of them, Reed said. So we knew that we could end up coming back and beat them. Stevens deemed the second quarter a key reason why Unity finished in front. During that 8-minute stretch, Knudsen and Reed opened up a shooting gallery to the tune of six three-pointers and 22 total points. That turned a 19-11 BHRA edge into a 33-26 Rocket lead by halftime. The basket was as big as a barrel in the first half, Eller said. We got a lot of confidence, and I thought that was the biggest part of the game. Ehlers also cited the defensive efforts of freshman Lauren Miller and sophomore Maddie Reed, rebounding of sophomore Taylor Henry, and substitute stability of senior Martina Mybeck as less heralded reasons the Rockets pulled off the outcome. Blue Devils standout Emily Medel capped her oft-dominant prop sorry, prep hoops tenure with 23 points. She finished 8-8 from the free throw line and drilled a three-pointer that put BHRA within 2 points with less than 2 minutes to play. "We just knew we were a good, hard-working team, and we worked hard Friday, too," Steven said. "Unity definitely deserved to win the game, and I think we can live with that." Unity now turns its attention to Monday's 6 p.m. to a Paris sectional semifinal game against Titopolis, who are 23-8, which recently won its 11th regional crown in as many seasons and owns second, third-place state finishes in the last 2 years. There's a fair chance Knutson Reed and everyone else in attendance at Friday's game will still be smiling by the time they arrive for the Rockets' next playoff game. "We'll worry about that Saturday," Eller said with a laugh. "We're going to celebrate." We'll move on to a headline from the Sunday section. ILLLIAY. He has a residence hall named after him, the school record for the longest tenure by a president, and the last name synonymous with some of the best times on campus. But in an Illini popularity contest, even Stan Eikenberry comes up short against the local legend who heads up the Alumni Association these days. Lou Lay is known and loved by more Illini worldwide than any other living human being, Eikenberry says. And, well, he should be. Lou loves Illinois, and over the years, Illinois loved him right back, head to toe. "For me, he was a lifeline to the heartbeat of Illinois. Though technically retired since 1998, when he ended his 20-year run as director, Lea is still as visible as ever at Illini functions, from hoops to homecoming, when the Alumni Association hands out one of its most cherished honors, the Lou Lay Spirit Award. Says former UI Chancellor Mort Weir, "I see him at events, and he is still the most popular person around." The year was 1958. Illinois had just wrapped up its first basketball season with black players in the lineup. A 16-year-old thumper named Butkus was turning heads at Chicago's Vocational High, and recent Blackburn College grad Lou Lea was about to take a break from his teaching career after 1 year to attend grad school here. "I had taught a year after undergrad and assumed I could make more money with a grad degree," Lea says. To help cover the cost of a second round of college, Lea accepted a job running the men's residence hall on 4th Street. It paid well for the time, $3,600 plus room and board, but that's not the part that Lea remembers most about his experience 6 decades later. "I lived in Clark for 2 years and then moved to Snyder when we opened the new MRH. I was then manager for 1,500 undergraduate men. I wouldn't trade it, but I would not want to do it again and to go to school full time. I survived water fights, res hall food strikes, pantry raids, and other entertainment which happened on study day. And yet he was hooked on the place, earning his master's in 1962 and charting a new career course. It started with a job at the UI Foundation. There were seven of us, seven. Today, there are hundreds in development," which led Lea in 1966 being named director of special programs of the organization he'd gone on to lead. "Memories galore when I joined the UI Alumni Association," he said. "Among them, reaching 100,000 alumni members, a first in higher education, and that was after having a drop a few names from the rolls after the office converted to computers. It was a mess. A man in Peabody, Massachusetts was getting 50 copies of the Illini News, and we found that the South Farms cows, Bessie and Myrtle, were in our database. It took a complete audit to make it right. And best of all, I've been blessed to share these memories with my wife, Mary, and daughters for 55 years. The University of Illinois has been good to all of us." We'll pause now to take a break.